20-4103, Leonard Mazzola versus Anthony Tagliati et al. Oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Ms. Jaron for the defendant's appellant.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
May it please the court. My name is Maya Jaron. I represent the City of Independence, former Chief of Police Michael Kilbane, and Law Director Gregory O'Brien. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes, please, for rebuttal.
That's fine, and you may proceed.
The court should reverse the district court's denial of qualified immunity to Chief Kilbane and Mr. Mazzola's First Amendment retaliation claim for three primary reasons. The first, there was no constitutional violation because Mr. Mazzola voluntarily retired. He did not suffer an adverse action. Second, even if Mr. Mazzola engaged in protected speech on a matter of public concern, the city certainly had a legitimate interest in investigating the theft of its internal documents and violations of its public record policies. And finally, Chief Kilbane did not violate Mr. Mazzola's clearly established constitutional rights as established at the time of his retirement. So, by way of very, very brief background, I'm sure you've read the briefing. As we know, Mr. Mazzola's 1983 claim, it arose out of the employment context, and it concerns the theft and improper release of internal police documents. So the city discovered that documents concerning the police department's...
Well, if I may, I mean, some of this is about his conversations with the HR person and the mayor, right?
Certainly it is. And I would, as we set forth in our briefing, those internal complaints, we would argue, are not protected.
It was completely outside of the chain of command for him. Right?
It was. It certainly concerned, it did concern the direct order he was given to implement a productivity standard. And in fact, that product, the complaints he were making, not only were they, was he falsely claiming that the standard was illegal, but also he was advocating for his own personal point system. So it's more like an internal dispute rather than a matter of public concern on that issue.
Well, I mean, I don't mean to sort of derail your opening, I'm sorry, but as to whether it's a matter of public concern, I mean, he's saying that this is unlawful, unethical, you know, to have a quota for tickets, to force officers to sort of drum up citations and to focus on out-of-state residents. That seems to be, why isn't that very much a matter of public concern?
Well, even putting that aside, if that were the case,
okay,
the adverse actions that he's complaining about in this case are laser-focused. The investigation that the police, that the city implemented was right, laser-focused on the release of documents and the violation of policies. The polygraph, likewise, was laser-focused on the release of documents. And any discipline, if it was ever contemplated, again, nothing was ever... Mr. Mazzola was never actually disciplined. Had he been disciplined, we don't know what it would have been, but certainly it would have arisen as a result of the investigation and polygraph. So to the extent he did speak with HR and the mayor, that may have happened, but the investigation and the adverse actions argued here were laser-focused on the theft of documents.
Okay. Well, I hear your argument.
So we know that several documents were released without public records request or authorization because a news story featured actual screenshots of two documents and two more were directly quoted. Now, we don't know if anyone spoke to the media. All we know is that documents were taken from the police department and released in violation of public records policies. And because those policies had obviously been violated, the chief hired an outside investigator. He conducted an investigation. And I want to point out that investigation did not focus on Mr. Mazzola. In fact, six police officers were investigated. The investigator determined that only Mr. Mazzola had access to all the documents implicated. And so he was given a polygraph, which he failed. The investigation never concluded. No discipline was ever issued because Mr. Mazzola decided to retire more than a week later after consulting with his union FOP rep.
So when you say he decided to retire, there's a little bit more to it than that, right? I mean, you have the emails from Mr. O'Brien and indications that that maybe the mayor and the chief, I'll use the word strongly urging Mr. Mazzola to retire. So I guess I'm not sure I would frame it as just like a simple retirement, and he is claiming a constructive discharge.
He is, Your Honor. That's correct. And I would argue, as we set forth in our briefs, that the purported threats that are discussed here don't rise to the level of a constructive discharge. So the circuit has pretty strongly rejected the idea that threats and proposed changes to job duties that are not implemented are adverse actions. So, and there are a few instances where threats have risen to that level, and I'll tell you that there are some criteria that need to be met for that to happen.
Well, let me just ask you factually first. He did receive some Mr. Mazzola some emails from Mr. O'Brien that basically, or maybe from his union rep, saying, you've got to retire by 5 o'clock on such and such a day, otherwise you're going to be demoted to patrolman. You'll be supervised by people you used to supervise. I mean, those facts are not in dispute.
Well, the timing of those facts, I want to clarify.
Okay.
So certainly, Mr. Mazzola's union representative, his attorney, or the attorney for the FOP, discussed with Mr. O'Brien what the city may have potentially done. What's not disputed is no decision was made. Mr. Phillips had already conveyed to the city that Mr. Mazzola decided to retire. After that took place, out of pure curiosity, because again, Mr. Phillips didn't know what the city was going to do, he requested from Mr. O'Brien, hey, can you please provide a list of what the city would have done if Mr. Mazzola had not decided to retire? So it was after the decision to retire had been conveyed to the city that the email from Mr. O'Brien came through saying, hey, this is what I think they would have done. But again, there's no question in this case that no one knew exactly what would have happened. The investigation didn't conclude. No decision had been made. No decision.
There's some jury issues here, you know?
Well, there is no dispute that no decision had been made.
I'm just speaking for myself. I'll tell you, I think you got a tough road on the question whether there was an adverse action and on causation. I mean, you know, we have testimony in this case that Mr. Mazzola is told on a Friday, you better be gone by Monday or else, you know, a number of really unpleasant things are going to happen to you. And lo and behold, he retires. I mean,
in
the posture the case comes to us, I really struggle to see how you have any out on those issues.
I appreciate that.
Just to, you know, like focus things.
Sure. And I will say as far as the timing, remember Mr. Mazzola's decision to retire was conveyed to the city on the 28th. And only after that decision was conveyed, it was done. Mr. Mazzola had decided to retire.
Friday, right?
It was on a Wednesday.
Okay.
And only after that was conveyed, the city said, okay, you've decided to retire. Let's formalize that by Friday. So the decision to retire and its timing on that was Mr. Mazzola's decision. He was polygraphed. He consulted.
I'm just telling you, I'm extremely skeptical that this is like this totally volitional thing that is not at gunpoint, so to speak, at least that a jury, you know, that the record could support that finding.
But as a matter of law, Your Honor, there's considerable.
I mean, we can keep talking about it if you want, but go ahead.
Well, as a matter of law, Your Honor, there is considerable case law from this jurisdiction and other jurisdictions finding that even threats of discipline, so such as we have in this case, simply don't rise to the level of either an adverse action or a constructive discharge. They have to be direct and they have to be unambiguous. As far as a direct, the cases that have held that threats relayed even through a township's attorney weren't enough. A threat conveyed through a deputy chief based on his speculation that if the plaintiff went through a disciplinary hearing, there's no chance that he would ever prevail. That wasn't enough. In addition, the threats here, to the extent they were threats, were unambiguous by definition because they hadn't been decided. In fact, if a pre-disciplinary notice had ever been issued, we don't know if any discipline would have actually been given to Mr. Mazzola. So yes, based...
To go back to the first prong, constitutionally protected speech, the fact that he's speaking outside of the chain of command, that does support a determination that he's speaking as a private citizen under our case law. Isn't that fair?
It does, except when the content of the speech concerns more of a personal grievance and is pursuant.
Let's say that, I mean, I struggle to see how that's true. I mean, what he's describing in terms of the ticketing policy, some people might regard as deplorable. And And certainly, it's not a matter that affects only people inside the police building. Quite the contrary. It affects outsiders driving through the town, people from Michigan driving through the town. Why isn't that very much a matter of public concern? That's why the TV station was interested in the whole thing.
Well, even if it is, Your Honor, I'd like to take a step to the third prong of that analysis, and it's whether the city had a legitimate interest at all in determining whether its public policy public records policies had been violated. And here, again, the investigation that the city conducted was laser-focused on if Mr. Mazzola didn't release these documents, someone did. And if only Mr. Mazzola had access to them, who the heck did?
What were the policies like content in terms of the release? I mean, if one was going to go about this according to the policies, what would that look like?
Well, the policy is very neutral, Your Honor. It simply says that a public records request may go through a designated person, and that person is trained and understands public records laws. And obviously, failing to respond or improperly responding to a public records request can leave a city open to significant liability. So they have a reason for this policy is if a document is requested or information is requested, certainly it's available to you. It has to simply go through the proper channels.
Substantive criteria for release. I mean, is there any reason to think this would have been withheld?
No, Your Honor. Had a public records request been made, it would have been produced. In fact, a reporter did make such a public records request, and it was responded to. But the logical conclusion of this type of a case is that any employee at their own discretion can go into the file cabinet, open it up, take a document they think is a public record, but we don't know if it is.
That's a fair point.
And disclose it as they see fit.
Wasn't there some indication, I may be mistaken in this, I thought I saw somewhere in the record that there were other people who had access to the records, and not just to Mr. Mazzola.
Well, there were a number of records, Your Honor, and that's correct. Two of them were more widely distributed than the others. But there is testimony from the investigator, and I believe from Mr. Mazzola himself, confirming that a very, very few people had access to, for instance, there was a grievance or a disciplinary notice issued to an officer, so it's a personnel record that would not be publicly available. And also one was a notice of predisciplinary hearing to Mr. Mazzola, again, not publicly available to anyone but him or his counsel.
But he's not the only one who had access to the records. It looks like there were limited access as to one thing or another, but I just want to make sure I'm clear in terms of whether he is the only one who had access or whether there were a few others. I thought the record says that there are a few others.
The investigator concluded he was the only one with access to all four, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank
but
you.
But there were, okay, well, that's fine.
Oh,
thank you. You know what? One question. We've got these cases that are set back to back, but they're obviously related. Should these be argued at the same time? Do we need to have separate arguments? I know Mr. Toke, the former mayor, it's got a separate case.
You may
address. Just looking for efficiency,
Your Honor,
for you and for the court.
We should have figured this out sooner.
We had prepared separately just because of the way that the oral argument was structured on the notice and the timing. So that's the way we prepared for today.
Okay. Well, I was
just going to say I'm content to wait because part of my concern coming in today was that I was going to be repeating myself, which you know, my wife says I do all the time anyway.
Yeah.
So I thought, for me, it would make more sense to just address everything at the end, but I'll do whatever the court wants.
I'd be fine.
I just have counsel for the other defendant.
Just argue now.
I think
it would be fine if it's okay with you that we could just hear from the other defendant.
I hope
we're
not surprising somebody.
You
need a minute to sort of.
Yeah. Because otherwise it seems to me we're going to take another half hour.
I hope we're not throwing you off on this, sir.
But let us know if that works for you. I mean, if it's
take whatever time you need here.
We had talked about that.
I forgot.
I did too.
No rush.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Does this work for you?
Yes, it works fine. It's fine, okay. Your Honor. Thank you.
Great.
So I would like to reserve 4 minutes if I could, please.
Okay. Sure.
I don't know if I have 4 minutes given the structure we're now in.
That's all
but,
right. Yeah, whatever.
But thank you.
Whom do you represent?
So I'm John McLandrich. I represent Mayor Togliatti.
Very good.
Only.
Okay.
And good morning. Mayor Togliatti is obviously differently situated than the city and Chief Kilbane in this litigation. His participation in the matter is very limited. He signed the contract for the investigator that was recommended by Labor Council. That act is clearly not supportive of a constitutional violation. He was informed that a polygraph was to be given. Plaintiff characterizes it in the briefing as approving the polygraph. The testimony doesn't support that characterization. The chief's testimony on the matter was that he informed the mayor that this polygraph was going to happen. And the argument is, well, the mayor could have stopped it. There's no reason to believe that he should have stopped it or that failing to stop it supports a constitutional violation on the part of the mayor. The argument then goes that subsequent to the failure of the polygraph, there was discussion again between Labor Council, Law Director, Chief, and apparently ultimately the mayor about Mr. O'Brien, who used to work with the FOP attorney, reaching out to the FOP attorney to discuss the issue of the potentiality of discipline. As we all know, there was no charges ever filed, there was no discipline ever brought, and so the question with respect to Mr. Togliatti really becomes this question of whether the mere fact that the city's law director was going to broach the topic of what's going to develop with respect to this incipient discipline is enough to impose on Mr. Togliatti some perception that he should have known that if he didn't intercede in this dialogue, that he would be constructively discharging Mr. Mazzola.
Didn't the mayor have a somewhat active role in this whole episode, starting with the, what do you call it, the, I guess they're calling it the program of some sort, but the, I'll just call it a ticketing quota system.
Yeah.
And discussions with the chief of police, Kilbane. The mayor has, I thought I saw a pretty, can be very involved in hiring and firing of law enforcement, and so it's a little bit less than a passive role, I would say. I thought he was pretty active in wanting to make sure this policy was enforced and enforced fully, and at least there's an inference, I think, that he would have been involved in an adverse action here.
Your Honor, I think that's the difference between advocacy and evidence.
Okay.
And, you know, it's maybe quality advocacy, but there's no evidence.
I'd love to hear quality advocacy.
Yes, as do I. So Mayor Togliatti approached Chief Kilbane inquiring about why the numbers of tickets and, of course, therefore revenue in Mayor's Court was down. He did not direct Chief Kilbane to institute a ticket quota, didn't advocate for one. Chief Kilbane addressed the matter with Mr. Mazzola with respect to how to address the lack of productivity. The idea that the quota, and just to correct, I think, a misperception, was to be focused on out-of-state drivers or in-town drivers is just not reflected in the policy. But irrespective of that, Mayor Togliatti was not involved in any such dialogue. He does have a meeting with Mr. Mazzola and the HR director where Mr. Mazzola is expressing his belief that there's a misperception with respect to the underlying statistics that are being used by Chief Kilbane to support his perceived need to address the lack of ticket productivity. Mr. Mazzola's testimony on that issue is that that conversation was not outside the chain of command. As a matter of fact, in his deposition, he specifically testified, no, that was absolutely normal part of my duties because I was sort of second in command, so to speak, because the chief was out on disability leave, I think, for a shoulder surgery or something. But
so you're saying that Mr. Mazzola testified that when he complained, so to speak, to your client, that he was acting within the chain of command?
Yes, and that can be found in his deposition at, I believe, it is pages 210 and 211. Part of my duty was to communicate with the mayor. I'd become a normal part of my job, was paraphrasing, of course,
okay,
his testimony. But, you know, what we have here is this body of case law, which admittedly is focused primarily in due process cases, that the voluntary retirement is presumptively that, voluntary. And then the question becomes, the legal question becomes, when should the employer know or be on notice, let's say, that this presumptively voluntary resignation has now been coerced? And there's...
Well, on that point, I think the toughest fact for your client is the conversation that Mr. Mazzola apparently has the day after he resigned, where he says to the mayor, he's crying and begging for his job back, supposedly. And then the mayor says, Lenny, you retired, and this is the important part, part of your retirement was not having this investigation completed and put into your disciplinary file. I mean, that statement's attributed to your client. And I guess in a case that's about First Amendment retaliation, why isn't that, you know, alleged statement by your client evidence that he was fully aware of this threat that was made to Mazzola that if you don't retire, you are going to have this investigation, you are going to have bad stuff in your disciplinary file?
Yeah. So, first off, again, I think the nomenclature of threat is good advocacy, perhaps, but not supported in the record.
Second, let's say we think it is a threat.
Okay. Presuming that, first off, that statement is after the fact. So
right.
The retirement
but after the
has
fact,
fact,
things can illuminate what was going on, right?
I mean,
it's just, I'm just trying to be candid with you.
No,
and you're not fencing here,
yeah,
but... Just about that is my biggest concern with your client.
Yeah, and I appreciate that fact. I think what we have here is, and this is sort of part of the struggle that I have with this case, right? So if, in fact, the plaintiff's version of the way this should come down is correct, now we have a situation where if someone's under investigation, there's incipient discipline that could result, the city can never go to that, in this case, union rep, they don't go directly to the person, right, and have a conversation, a conceptual conversation with counsel about a potential resolution for discipline. I think what Mayor Togliatti's comments after the fact reflect is that now his understanding is that an accord has been made. You know, so you've agreed to resign. As a result of agreeing to resign, we've agreed to do certain things. We've agreed to not complete the investigation. We've agreed not to put these materials that have been developed so far in the investigation in your file, and simply recognizing that. And, you know, I have, I can't say never, but I can't recall a situation where when someone has resigned their employment for whatever reason, even if it's not tied to discipline, and then the next day comes back and says to the employer, geez, you know, I've changed my mind. I really don't want to resign or retire, that that the city has said, no, come on back. So having that sort of after-the-fact conversation of, we don't think it's appropriate for you to come back. Geez, Lenny, it's too late. I don't think supports a First Amendment retaliation claim. And I think that, as I've looked at this case, I think that constructive discharge and retirement are a little bit different animals in a qualitative sense. And obviously, they're on the continuum, right? If we have an employee who's got 30 years left to work, 20 years left to work, the idea they're being constructively discharged, I think, is evaluated in a different light than when you have someone who is now, you know, essentially almost at retirement age. And I think it impacts the perception of the voluntariness and this whole coercion factor. But what's troubling to me is, are we going to be left with a standard where now, yes, the mayor's the final decision maker if discipline's recommended. Of course, no discipline has been recommended. Has there been conversation about whether discipline should perhaps result? I presume there was internal conversation in that regard once a police officer fails a polygraph exam. But now what we have is a situation where how early does the employee get to pull the ripcord, decide they're going to retire, and then try to hold, in this case, my client, the mayor, responsible when he's had no decision to make? And so, you know, we're going to have a situation where, again, can an employer ever have that candid conversation with union counsel? Because now they have the threat of, if they have that conversation, the employee decides to retire, you know, now they're on the horns of the dilemma, because the next day the employee can say, but I didn't really want to. And particularly against the backdrop of the case law from the circuit, where the threat of termination, the threat of demotion in and of itself is not sufficient, and particularly where we have the case law from the circuit about the standard for voluntariness, which, again, the district court didn't even choose to pay lip service to, particularly on the facts with respect to Mayor Tagliati, and I know I'm out of time. Okay, thank you, right. Your Honors.
You'll have your full rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
May it please the court, and welcome to Cleveland. You're true circuit judges now.
Yeah. Thank you.
But true. Oh, it's nice to be here.
Riding the circuit.
Yes.
I see. I get it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very good. We'd have to be on horseback, though.
Your Honors, I'm Subodh Chandra, and I'm presenting on behalf of appellee Leonard Mazzola, who's here in the courtroom today. A lot of what we heard in argument from opposing counsel was argument that's beyond the court's jurisdiction. It was argument about the sufficiency of the facts and whether the facts should really be construed in the light most favorable to the appellants. And this is of significant concern to the appellee because we came to this oral argument hoping that we were going to discuss the facts, first of all, in the light most favorable to Mr. Mazzola, former Lieutenant Mazzola. And then, secondly, that we weren't going to be put in a position where we were going to have to call out certain issues in the reading of the facts. But now we're in that position, and so I'm going to do that and, of course, answer the court's questions as we go.
And I, you know, in a qualified immunity appeal, I think we have to accept the district court's view of the record in the light most favorable to the plaintiff. So we're not deciding ourselves what we think, where we think that light most favorable lands. It's wherever the district court said it landed, right or wrong, and we take those facts, is my sense
of
it.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay.
So, you know, I guess really, I mean, to the point you're speaking to, I mean, specifics about what the district court said was, you know, the fact or the facts that a jury could find, I think, are what are critical.
Right. So I will go right to the heart of the concern here. And I'm going to choose my words carefully. The heart of the concern is, particularly on this issue of the voluntariness of the resignation or the retirement, and on the issue of whether that was a constructive discharge, on those issues, the district court found that there were sufficient facts that a reasonable jury could infer that Mr. Mazzola didn't retire voluntarily. This was a constructive discharge, and therefore it was an adverse action in retaliation for his exercise of First Amendment rights. The challenge that we're having today in this courtroom is an argument that suggests, based on the record before you, that there's no evidence that, and it's somehow undisputed, that Mr. Mazzola voluntarily retired. You heard these arguments about timing, for example, that somehow the union attorney had only conveyed a threat after the fact, or the conversation with Mayor Togliatti was after the fact. But although we are constrained by this record, I'd just like the panel to note that we did file a motion to supplement the record based on evidence that Judge Gwynne obtained later after the notice of appeal, and that in those circumstances, the kind of direct evidence is there in the record. It just wasn't considered by the court before the appeal. We did file a motion before a motions panel. The motions panel's position was, we're not going to consider that evidence because...
We kind of deal with the record as it comes to us. We're not creating a new one.
Exactly. The concern I have, though, it's as though we are, and again, I'm choosing my words carefully, the concern we have, it appears to be to raise concern under Rule 3.3 of the Ohio Rules of Professional Conduct, in which lawyers are constrained from presenting arguments about facts or arguments about law that they know not to be true.
Well, I don't think this is moving the ball very much in terms of us understanding.
Okay.
We know how to review the record in this case, and what we have to take is fixed.
Okay, so I'll move on then.
I don't think you need to worry about that.
Okay.
But just tell us, to the extent that they're saying something different than what the district court said a jury could find, if you want to point that out specifically, that's very helpful.
Then I'll turn to those specifics then, Your Honor. Thank you for that guidance. One of the contentions that was made by my learned counsel, Ms. Jaron, was the idea that there was a laser-focused investigation on the theft of documents. That's simply not true under this record. There may be a recasting of that, an effort to recast that as a theft of documents, but it's clear from the record, and this is laid out in our brief, that the investigation was focused on the news report and the fact of the news report. And documents were a part, public records were a part of the news report, but it's also clear that there were things that were said by the reporter that weren't in the records. And so we've submitted in the brief, here's what the records were, here's what the records said, and here's additional information presented by the reporter that could have only come from an oral communication. So I don't think that the court needs to even reach an issue or consider an issue about whether somehow dissemination of public records is some kind of special category in which there may be qualified immunity, because the record here shows that the speech at issue was not just the dissemination of public records, not sensitive, confidential, internal police documents, just public records, combined with oral statements that must have been made to the reporter, combined with, as Judge Kethledge pointed out, the reports outside of the chain of command.
I mean, so we're talking about what is the supposedly protected speech issue here.
Correct.
And there are a few different things that could fall in that category. Speech to the mayor, speech to HR, speech to a reporter, release of documents. Does that pretty much sum up the categories?
Correct.
So we're talking about the last two. And they're saying, if we're retaliating based on release of documents in violation of our procedures, that's totally legit. You're saying, well, be that as it may, somebody also talked to the reporter, and that's protected. What about the fact that your client denies he talked to the reporter?
Well, so under the Heffernan case from the U.S. Supreme Court, Heffernan v. City of Paterson, New Jersey, even the wrongful perception that someone engaged in protected speech can be the subject of a retaliation claim. So the Supreme Court has settled that question, and this court in the DeCrane case on September 1st reaffirmed and applied that.
Okay. That's
so helpful. So well, now, well, there's no dispute, of course, over the conversations with the mayor and the conversations
and so
with the
HR
director.
Point, though, how are you able to bring that speech to the mayor, speech to HR, into a First Amendment retaliation claim, in the sense of, you know, how can you show a causal connection between that speech in particular and the outcome of, as you see it, coerced retirement?
Well, as the court has repeatedly pointed out over and over again, the issue of the causal connection is one entrusted to a jury. It's a fact question.
Not always. I mean, we affirm summary judgments all day long on cases, on issues that are fact questions.
Okay.
There's just the evidence doesn't create a genuine issue as to a particular.
So the causal connection could be shown in several ways. I mean, first of all, there's clearly an investigation that is launched over it. There's an investigation that is launched with respect to Mr. Mazzola being strapped to a polygraph, which is a pretty
severe.
All this
is about the documents and the news report, right?
Oh, I see what you're saying.
So, I get what you're saying there, but how do we know, what evidence is there that they retaliate based upon the speech to the mayor and the speech to HR in particular?
Fair enough. So the Mr. Mazzola has testified that and I believe that there is testimony in the record about specifically they were also going after him over going outside of the chain of command. That is something that Mayor Togliatti said, and the district court clearly found that to be a viable avenue here for a jury to find that that could be one of the motivating factors going outside of the chain of command. And these are matters of public concern, and Mr. Mazzola has the right to approach the court. To approach his supervisor over those kinds of concerns and the HR director.
This would be the district court's October 15 order?
I believe
that
so.
That adjudicates
I believe it's there, and if it isn't there, we know it's in the record. I'm sorry, I don't have it at
all
my fingertips right now.
Do you think the court found, you think the court determined that a jury could find that some of these actions were in response to the speech to the mayor and the speech to HR?
That's my recollection at this moment. My recollection isn't specific as to whether the court specifically addressed that. What I do know is that Mr. Mazzola testified, and I believe we had additional. What I'm trying to avoid is discussing the information that hasn't been approved to be considered, right? I know with certainty it's sitting there, right? The issue of the chain of command. But as
no
to...
No hints either.
Exactly. So, but what was clear to Mr. Mazzola was that he was also being accused of having gone outside of the chain of command, and as this court has affirmed time and time again, that when you're considering public employee speech, that's one of the factors you consider as a matter of law whether the speech is protected speech. Now, in addition to that, I don't want the court to overlook the last paragraph of Mr. Mazzola's declaration in opposition to summary judgment, where he talks about the decision to retire and talks about how he gave up his drop pension. It really wouldn't make any sense for anybody to walk away from such a massive pension payment if he just serves out a few more years of public service. So I think that's one of the facts that the court can consider on whether or not this was truly a voluntary retirement. Certainly an issue for a jury to decide whether this is truly a voluntary retirement. I also want to draw the court's attention to, I think there's a schism in the case law that's being presented on whether threats or proposed charges can be an adverse action. My understanding of many of the cases being cited by both appellants here for the proposition that somehow threats aren't enough, proposed charges aren't enough, are from the Title VII context. And I think it's important that the court focus on what an adverse action is in First Amendment retaliation law, which is anything that could cause a person of ordinary firmness to not engage in the protected activity. I'm not saying that's true of all of the cases, but I think that's an important distinction where at one extreme, this court and others have looked at even whether one gives a birthday cake at a party as something that might be something that causes a person of ordinary firmness not to exercise their rights, then certainly a situation where there is a specter of severe discipline, that is a serious issue. And if you look at Mr. Mazzola's affidavit, or his declaration rather, what is clear from his vantage point is that it was communicated to him that he would be facing a potential demotion and then branded a Brady Giglio lying cop, which would then result in termination. So if that wouldn't cause a person of ordinary firmness to be wary, I don't know what else would.
The district court doesn't have much to say, frankly, on page 11 of his order regarding why this is in retaliation for the conversation with the mayor and with HR. So okay. I know your client said he thought that. You know the case a lot better than I do. If you were sort of writing the opinion, I mean, is there anything else you'd point to that would support a finding that the retaliation was tied to those two things?
The fact that the retaliation occurred and that it was so close in time to the protected activity. I think that would be sufficient. If you're not able to find additional testimony to that effect, and I apologize for not having that at my fingertips. The other thing that I think, Judge Kethledge, you may have already pointed out is the issue of the traffic quota and its newsworthiness. I don't think the issue of public concern is really a serious issue in this case. And as I've also mentioned, this idea that somehow the investigation and all these efforts were just laser focused on a violation of public records policy is just pretextual in light of all of the other information presented.
What is some of that? Because, I mean, I think that's one of their better arguments.
Yes.
Is, hey, you know, we have this policy and public record or not, you know, we can't have people just coming in here on their own and doing this sort of thing. And if this is all just a legitimate follow-up to that, then, you know, it's not First Amendment retaliation.
Well, the analogy I would use, Your Honor, would be social media policies, which have also been litigated, right? So a municipality can adopt a social media policy. A municipality can adopt a public records policy. But that doesn't mean that the policy itself is on constitutionally firm ground if it's overbroad. And so if the First Amendment protects under the Lane v. Franks set of cases, if the First Amendment protects a public employee from learning about things that may be of public concern during the course of the job and then communicating them as a private citizen, then why wouldn't the First Amendment protect a public employee's ability to disseminate public records? These are the people's records. We're not talking about law enforcement confidential records.
Yeah, maybe you have to go through the process, you know? I mean, if you're talking about a First Amendment right just to go in there, grab a bunch of files and walk out because you've made your own determination, not you, but, you know, the person has, that, hey, this is a public record.
I
don't think, you know, the First Amendment necessarily runs over those processes for doing this.
If they were
to deny it, that's another matter, you know.
I would respectfully disagree, Your Honor, for this reason. Because if you look at the interests that the Lane v. Franks case is trying to protect from the Supreme Court, it's trying to protect not only the interests of public employees and their ability to learn matters of public concern on the job and communicate about them as private citizens, but it's also trying to protect the public's right to access that information. The spirit of that decision is one that is really talking about, we want public employees to talk about matters of public concern and things that are going wrong. And so if those things are provable within public records, we're not talking about confidential records or attorney files or anything like that. We're talking about public records. Then the ability to, say, communicate to a journalist and turn over a public record has to be protected as a matter of constitutional law because there's no really analytical difference between orally communicating that and just communicating a document that shows that or proves that. In any event, non-issue here because we've got non-public record information that was disseminated to the reporter. And then wrapping up, I think the other issue that I want to address is on Mayor Togliatti's role. Mayor Togliatti's role is far broader and deeper than what's being suggested by my learned opposing counsel here. Mayor Togliatti was the person who ordered the investigation, had a conversation with Lenny Mazzola that was outside of the chain of command, was, again, I'm not permitted to talk about information outside of the record, but there was enough information that the district court found to suggest that he had his fingerprints all over this and was working in close concert with the law director, Greg O'Brien, and with Chief Kilbane. That ought to be enough to continue to hold him liable. Does the court have
what's,
any?
What's the record evidence you would point us towards for he ordered the investigation?
Yeah, it's cited in our brief. Let me turn to it here. And I think it was just conceded by opposing counsel.
Or if you can recall that, you know, just the gist of it.
Yeah, it's in the facts section of our brief, Your Honor. Again, I'm not able to pull it up immediately, but I think it was conceded by opposing counsel that he had been somebody who, you know, had approved the investigation. I mean, he had approved the investigation.
But you don't recall, it was this person's depth where that came out or something?
Yeah, so I know that there's a sentence in our brief citing to the record where Mr. Evans, who was the investigator, that it was Togliatti who approved that hiring.
Okay.
And I believe that there is a record to that effect. So I don't think that's in dispute.
Evans?
I'm sorry?
Was he deposed in this case, Evans?
I believe he was, yeah. Yeah, and what's interesting is that one of the most interesting aspects of his testimony and the documentation that he provided was notes that he had with conversations with attorneys for the city in which he wrote in his notes, retaliation could be an issue or retaliation could be a problem, words to that effect. And so, look, the city understood what it was doing, why it was doing it, and all of that evidence taken together does support a First Amendment retaliation claim. I do want to mention one last thing, an argument that hasn't been discussed yet, which is that even if this court looks at a particular aspect of the adverse action and has doubts over whether that really is an adverse action or not, this court's case law supports that you can take all of the adverse actions together in the aggregate and find that they support an adverse action under the First Amendment. What I would request as relief, Your Honor, is that if the court does not simply affirm the decisions from Judge Gwynn, then we would ask that you remand to the trial court below, not just for a decision consistent with the court's opinion, but also for further consideration of the additional evidence that was adduced in the record.
And I guess I would just ask in terms of your request, with these qualified immunity cases, there are always questions as to whether we should affirm or whether we even have jurisdiction. So your view is that we have jurisdiction of the various issues that have been argued today, and we simply affirm, or that we just affirm a lack of jurisdiction?
So my view is that the court has jurisdiction over the issue of qualified immunity as a matter of law, but does not have jurisdiction over the kinds of factual issues that are being argued by the appellants. And so to the extent that the court is going to look outside of Judge Gwynn's fact findings and the evidence that he was looking at in the record and weigh facts, the court doesn't have jurisdiction over that, over the issue of evidentiary sufficiency.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Jarrett?
Excuse me. All right, thank you, Your Honors. Just want to quickly state a couple things in rebuttal to Mr. Chandra. I don't think anyone in this case disputes that the city was merely contemplating discipline at the time that Mr. Mazzola decided to retire. I mean, what was said, when it was said, really doesn't matter at the end of the day in the fact that no decision had been made. There was a process that had to be gone through under the collective bargaining agreement. A notice of predisciplinary hearing had to be issued. So many steps had to be taken. And we don't know what discipline would have been proffered had those steps been taken.
I mean, why isn't this factual argument beyond our jurisdiction? I mean, the district court said, viewed in the light most favorable to Mazzola, the defendants gave him an ultimatum. Take this early retirement or else, you know, terrible things are going to happen. And a reasonable jury could find that the threatened punishment went beyond criticisms and was enough to show intolerable working conditions. I mean, we can't say, no, the evidence doesn't support that. I mean, that we just can't do that in this appeal.
The evidence is what it is. However, the law is also what the law is. And the law of this circuit and other circuits as well is pretty clearly established. And the clearly established law is that threats that are not directly conveyed, that are not unambiguous, simply don't rise to the level
of an
adverse
action. How about ultimatums, you know? I mean, the court said the evidence supports the finding that the defendants gave him an ultimatum. I mean, we can't. So, I mean, that's a fixed part of our landscape here, that your client, that somebody on the defense side gave this plaintiff an ultimatum.
And if
that, you know, this, you know, you're a liar thing and all that, I mean, serious stuff. Nothing we can do about that in a QI appeal.
Nothing we can do about it. We can't change the fact that it was not relayed directly, only through a large game of telephone, and that it was simply unambiguous as to what the specific discipline would have been. But turning to the standard raised by Mr. Chandra, I just want to mention that there are also threats have been considered under the Title VII and the First Amendment retaliation context. This circuit, or courts in this circuit, have rejected the birthday party test in that not being invited to someone's birthday party is enough for a constructive discharge or adverse action. That's simply
not. I'd rather
not
be invited to those cake parties.
I would like
I
to be invited
those.
Too, but it's simply not enough in this Redful. Case or any case. If you look at the Kubala versus Smith case out of this circuit, which was cited by Mr. Mazzola, it clearly shows the argument that we're making here also is that threats are adverse actions only if made with authority, with clarity, and repeatedly, and we don't have any of those elements here. And I just want to conclude by reiterating that the city certainly had a legitimate interest in investigating the theft of documents. The investigation questioned the release of documents. The polygraph questioned about...
Real quick, because obviously you're out of time. What about Mr. Chandra's point that the investigation concerned the news report more generally, including some kind of non-documentary speech that was made to the reporter?
Well, we have the questions. I know we have the questions from the polygraph in the record, and those were specifically narrowly tailored to the release of documents. So that was certainly laser focused. It never asked, did you speak to the media? Did
okay,
you talk
to but there
to
was
them?
More going on than just the polygraph.
Correct. And the investigation itself also focused on documents, to my recollection, and I believe those that information is in the record.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot.
Great. Thank you, counsel. Landridge?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honors. Very briefly, with respect to this issue of Mayor Togliatti ordering the investigation, simply not supported in the record. The citation in the brief doesn't support it when you read the testimony. Mr. Evans doesn't say that. The testimony is that the mayor signed the contract that was brought to him with respect to the retention of Mr. Evans. He didn't tell someone to go find Mr. Evans or to start an investigation. That was decision-making that was conducted between Labor Council and
why couldn't
Chief of Police.
I mean, again, it's kind of how the district court construed this signing and the import of that, but why isn't that, I mean, like, approval? I mean, if they needed his signature to go forward, that suggests pretty strongly they needed his approval to go forward, and he gave it. So why isn't that approving the investigation?
Well, first off, there's the question of whether approving the investigation, signing the contract, certainly signing the contract allows the investigation to go forward. That doesn't necessarily mean he approves the entirety of the investigation, but even that aside, even assuming it does, the mere act of investigation is not the conduct that's alleged to be the constructive discharge in this case. The alleged constructive discharge is the statement that's been characterized as a threat, that if you don't retire, some discipline will be instituted against you. And so the active investigation in and of itself is just simply, you know, a part of the story, if you will, but not the act of constructive discharge. And you know, sort of more fundamentally, from our perspective, I think that, you know, this issue of voluntariness, certainly that's a question to be decided. There's no question that the retirement itself was, on the surface, if you will, voluntary. He submitted the retirement. Now the question is whether that apparent voluntariness has been overborne by some coercion that converts it from something that was voluntary on its surface to something that was actually not voluntary. And that's where the Rhodes and the body of case law from this court, I think, is instructive and was not addressed by the district court. And, you know, what's happened in this First Amendment jurisprudence is that things have been borrowed from other areas of the law. Plaintiff's counsel made reference to Title VII, sure. And we have this body of case law with respect to Rhodes, which has sort of grown out of the due process side. But the question that the court has to confront is still fundamentally the same. Where is this balance to be struck between when an employee has got incipient discipline, they decide that they're going to leave to avoid any potential discipline that might result, and what impact does that have on the employer, particularly Merritt Togliatti, who's never had the issue of discipline brought to his chair where he said, yes, I'm going to demote this person, or yes, I'm going to fire this person, and is now being alleged to be held accountable on the First Amendment retaliation claim. The question is, would a reasonable public official, given this set of facts and this body of case law, in the position of Mayor Togliatti, have known that accepting the resignation would be deemed to be a unlawful coercion of someone's cessation of employment in violation of the First Amendment? And that issue, I think, needs to be resolved in favor of Mayor Togliatti. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay. Thank you, Counsel. Appreciate your briefing today and your argument, all very helpful. We'll take the case under submission.